Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations and Elections Committee to order. Representative Seltzer, have you taken a look at the minutes, and would you like to make a motion to approve those?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the minutes? All right, motions are approved. Very good. Minutes are approved. Members, we want to welcome today a special guest, former member of the House, former member to this committee, and chair of the Elections Committee the last biennium, and a great great man. Congratulations, Secretary of State Simon, on your win. We're looking forward to working with you in your capacity as Secretary of State and your knowledge that you certainly gained over the years from working on these committee. And with that, we want to say welcome, and we'd like to turn the committee over to you for an introduction and an overview.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate the opportunity. It really is an honor to be in this office. It's an honor to be before this committee. All 10 years that I was in the legislature, I served on some form of this committee. It was called different names. It had a different portfolio at different times, but all 10 years I served here. And it was a great honor, and to you in particular, Mr. Chair, it was really a pleasure as co-legislators to work with one another. You've always been honorable and fair, and I know you're going to continue to do that. And I hope all members are enjoying their time so far in the committee. Listen to Mr. Gehring. That's my one piece of advice. He'll never steer you wrong. And he's been a great asset to this institution and this committee. Before I get started on the, I guess, more formal presentation, I wanted to introduce to you some members of the office that you might not know that are new and or senior to the office. I'll have them introduce themselves just so you can get a sense of them. And they are always, as they'll tell you, open and available to you at all times. As many of you know, the Office of Secretary of State, the Administrative Office, is here at the State Office Building on the first floor, and they will be available to you anytime for any reason. So they can introduce themselves.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Kaner Roth, and I am the new Deputy Secretary of State working with the office. We'll be working on legislative affairs with the Secretary, as well as other external affairs for the office. Glad to be here today.
Chair and members, I'm Julie Strother. I do government relations for the office. I work closely with Ann, and so you'll be seeing me around as well.
Thank you both, and welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, if I may, I do have a formal presentation, and I will try to avoid the great PowerPoint sin of just simply reading what you already have in front of you. I'll try to add some value. As you know, as I said, the Office of Secretary of State Administrative Office is here on the first floor. It really resides, though, in two buildings. One is here in the State Office Building, but the other is about eight blocks away or so on Empire Drive. And that's the other building that houses the business services functions. We'll get into those in a minute. And here, this next slide, you see staffing. Now, this isn't necessarily budget, but based on staffing, you see, and this surprises many people, that the majority of the staff in the office are not in the elections portion of the office, but rather in the business services portion of the office. I think we all know that when it comes to most public discussion of this office, certainly in an election context, it's the elections issues that hold sway. But in reality, the work of the office, when it comes to the numbers of people working on them, resides, the majority of it resides in the business services office, which is at that separate location. And I'll get into a minute what that means. There's also the Safe at Home program. Talk about that in a little bit later. Administrative functions and, of course, elections, which is the purview most directly of this committee, although this committee has a very broad and wide portfolio, as those of you who served on it before know. And so I wouldn't be surprised if business services or really any issue potentially come before this committee. So just quickly on business services, you can read what it says, but I wanted to highlight something in particular about business services in general that's new, that some of you who have been here before remember. There's a new entity, a new creature in Minnesota law. Minnesota joined now, I think, the majority of states in authorizing a new creature called the B Corporation. This isn't on the PowerPoint, but we've all heard, or many of us have, of the C Corporation, which is sort of the classic corporate entity. But many states, Minnesota now included, have now authorized this new entity called a B Corporation, which is, for lack of a better explanation, sort of a socially conscious but for-profit corporation. Because a for-profit corporation has an obligation to its owners, shareholders, if they have shareholders. And so it was trickier for a for-profit corporation to have maybe a social mission. It could be saving the rainforest. It could be promotion of a particular geographic area, but a for-profit entity. So that's something new that our office is dealing with as well, that is something that you don't see on the presentation. But you see here what some of the what some of those services are. There's a UCC, or Uniform Commercial Code Division. The UCC is basically a body of law uniform in, I think, all 50 states, if not almost all 50 states, which is a body of law, a uniform body of law that governs certain business transactions. So as you can see here, the UCC division helps administer those. It comes off up very frequently in the context of agriculture, where there's certain transaction, farm product liens and others, that require our office to get involved in terms of making sure that farmers get paid, the banks who are securing certain loans get paid, and operators, for example, of grain elevators, they also get paid, and that, you know, they can all transact business. So this comes up in a number of contexts, but that's one that may be familiar to some of you. Here's just a top-line view of filings. Sometimes people ask not only this Secretary of State's office, but others around the country who do similar work, what the filings are as somewhat of a barometer of business health. It's not the only thing, obviously, but this is one indication. You can draw your own conclusions, but this is the third highest annual total on record for new business filings. You can see the total business filings are over 300,000 this last time, of which 59,440 were new business filings. Just an interesting statistic. Some of you may know that, know or remember, those of you who served with former Representative King Banyan, for example, in the St. Cloud area. He and his colleagues at St. Cloud State University, those of you who don't know, he's an economics professor at St. Cloud State. He has worked with this office under the previous administration to use some of the data, like business filings, to draw greater conclusions about business health in various sectors of the state. Just heard from him a day or two ago. We're going to be meeting and seeing what more we can do in this area. Again, it's one piece of data, one piece of the puzzle. It's not everything. But he and his group at St. Cloud State have done some, I think, very impressive work using data like this to draw conclusions about economic trends. But this is one you can draw your own conclusions, perhaps. Election administration obviously comes to mind first, I would say, in the minds of most Minnesotans and probably most members when they think of this office. As I said, and as you saw, does not represent the majority of actual employees, but it represents a big part of the work of the office, certainly in the minds of the public. And you can see here some of the basic duties here of the office. You know, people joke, but I think it's true, that often a Secretary of State in any state is in the news when there's an election-related issue, contest, or controversy. I don't think it's any surprise that this office was in the news most probably in the last 10, 15 years when there was the Frank and Coleman recount or some other similar recount. In that instance, any secretary is sort of thrust into the news, thrust into the eye of the storm. Some of you remember Katherine Harris in Florida. You remember that name during the Bush v. Gore contest in the year 2000. That tends to be when secretaries of state are in the news, because that is a core function of the office, is making sure, particularly with statewide recounts, whether in a primary or general election, that those are administered fairly. But there's a training component as well, certification component that you can read for yourself. The one thing, though, that first bullet point, I think, is the most important, and we can talk about that a little bit later, but I think some people are under the mistaken impression that the Secretary of State sort of runs the election system. That, I don't think, is a fair assessment. I think it's a two-way, equal partnership between the Secretary of State's office and local units of government, most often counties. And many of you are in close contact with your county auditors or county auditor treasurers, particularly if you're from Greater Minnesota, and with good reason. They usually wear multiple hats, including but not limited to election duties, but they really are the front lines. I'd say that our county auditors in Minnesota, or auditor treasurers, they sometimes go by different names, they are the front lines of the election system. They are the ones who day to day, week in, week out, year in, year out, they're the ones who purchase the equipment, they're the ones who test the equipment, they are most often, not always, but most often the ones who recruit and train the election judges, and we have thousands and thousands of election judges. So they're the ones who really do a lot of the frontline work. And it's the Office of Secretary of State that helps them, that guides them, gives them what they need, but it really is a two-way partnership. And I have nothing but respect for the work that many of these folks do and these administrators do in the counties, particularly smaller counties in Greater Minnesota, where they are wearing multiple hats. where they're, for example, oftentimes in charge of the property tax administration system and in charge of the election system, and they do a lot, and they put on good elections, and sometimes under some challenging circumstances. So here are just some facts and figures on elections administration that you can read for yourself. I will note, as many of you know, we had for the first time this last election the new no-excuses absentee voting regime. That was passed, as you know, Mr. Chair, more than anyone, under on a bipartisan basis last session. Got a lot of support. Both major political parties in Minnesota really pushed it hard this last election. I saw blast emails from the DFL, blast emails from the Republican Party urging people to make use of it, and people did. One thing not on the PowerPoint was that compared with 2010, which is probably the best apples-to-apples comparison, a non-presidential election, there was a 55% increase in those who voted absentee. I conclude that that's in large part due to this new innovation and this new convenience. I think people really took to it and liked it, and I think that will probably only increase as the years go on, as people understand what it is, understand that it's available. So it's a tool that I think people really, really use. But you can see here some of the facts and figures that are relevant to our participation. I would point out, too, and people do ask about this, in terms of turnout, you know, Minnesota has always been a leader. It doesn't matter who's in charge, either the legislature, the governorship, or the Secretary of State's office, we have almost always been, if not number one, at the very top of the list when it comes to turnout. You ask me, it's not on the PowerPoint, I think that's due to a couple things. One is just culture. I think in Minnesota we're joiners, we're volunteers, we care about our community, and I think that's part of it. But another part is legislative, and that's, you know, in your hands and in your laps, which is over the years, regardless of who's in charge, we've tried to make voting, obviously within reason, as accessible to as many people as possible who are eligible to vote. And that's been a pretty bipartisan consensus over the last number of decades. So that's how I would account for it. But as many of you know, we took a little bit of a fall this last cycle. We were not number one. We were knocked off that perch. We were number six in the country. Still high, comparatively, but our turnout was about 50.2%, I think, in this last election. You know, for Minnesota, that's pretty low. For the rest of the country, again, it was six. Our modern-day high, in case you're wondering, they're almost always in presidential years, but our modern-day high was about 78% in the 2008 election. That was the modern high water mark, 78%, down to just over 50% this time. It was about 55% in 2010, the last non-presidential election, in case you're wondering. So the Safe at Home program is one that is probably little known, I would say, among the general public, and maybe even among some legislators. This was a program that was enacted by the legislature in 2006. Secretary Kiffmeyer was involved in that at the time. Secretary Ritchie, it came online really under Secretary Ritchie's tenure. And this is basically an address confidentiality, or really address anonymity program for victims of domestic violence. The standards for getting in are pretty high. This isn't for the person who in most instances just sort of speculates that they might need this protection. Law enforcement is involved, there are a lot of sign-offs. And as you can see, participation has risen close to tenfold, which is good and bad. It's good that people who need it, and believe me, the people who are in this program have jumped through enough hoops and hurdles with the legal system to prove that they need it. People who need it are getting the protection that they deserve. On the other hand, it's too bad that we need this in the first place. It's too bad that 2,000 people in Minnesota have to be, in essence, in a program much like, I guess, in the popular imagination, the witness protection program would be. It's apples to oranges, it's not the same thing. I don't want to represent that it is. But in the sense that it's very hard to find someone. It's an address anonymity program that our office handles, and it really is a lifesaver for a lot of people. You can see here the participation trends by year. There have been some spikes, and I know that this committee and other committees have been involved over the years with setting up guidelines either for eligibility or for extending protections. For example, last session, I know, obviously, overwhelmingly bipartisan, there was some legislation to make sure that we were extending more formal protections to the children of domestic abuse and domestic violence victims as well.
Mr. Secretary, to that point, and part of this is probably outside of your jurisdiction, but as we see the increase of participants, do you think that is due to the expansion of the program, or the ease of which these folks are made aware of the program, or is it more on the public safety side where we've actually seen a spike in these sorts of incidents?
I, Mr. Chair and members, I at this point can't speak as knowledgeably as to the second prong, but as to the first prong, I know there have been a lot of efforts over the last few years to make this better known. There are almost 80 community partners all over Minnesota that partner and help enroll people or at least educate them about their eligibility for enrollment in this program. So I think that network, the growth of that network, has contributed to people understanding that that option is out there. I don't know offhand the statistics about prevalence of domestic violence and whether that plays a role in this, but I can say my observation is that in terms of making it better known, making the program better known, and the eligibility criteria better known, there have been real strides taken in the last few years. So I suspect that's at least part of the explanation. Mr. Chair and members, though this is not a finance committee, I thought you would want to know a little bit something about the financing of the office. The bottom line for this office is that this office is a net contributor, a big one, to the state. About $10 million a year as a net contribution, more than our budget. And that's because in the business services area, for those who file various documents, there are fees. And those fees go into a big pot. We're allowed under state law to draw a certain amount of money from that pot, but the rest of it goes to the general fund. So this office makes more money for the state than it takes. And that's a fairly rare thing. I know there are a few places like that. The Commerce Department always talks about that, I know, in all their presentations. I used to serve on the Commerce Committee, and they would open up their presentation by saying that, so I'm following suit, even though this isn't a budget presentation. Just so you know that. Here you can see some sources of funding. And the bottom line here is that you can see several biennia ago, in 10 and 11, there were two sources of funding that are no longer on the table. One is HAVA. For those of you new to this area, that's the Help America Vote Act. And that was passed in the aftermath as federal legislation, passed by Congress in the aftermath of the Bush versus Gore 2000 election, when everyone agreed, whether you were for Bush or Gore or Nader or whoever, everyone agreed that Florida was a mess. Doesn't matter who you were for. There was a patchwork, and some had this equipment, and some had old equipment. And just from the standpoint of election administration, forget who ought to win. Everyone agreed. And so under the Bush administration, Congress passed HAVA, which was basically a big grant of money. It was more than that, but for this purpose, it was a big grant of money to the states so that they could get some standardization in place, buy election equipment that was modern, that was useful, and states did that. Well, that means that, but that money was one time, and that money is now gone. It is dried up. And so that isn't an option anymore for our office or any office around the state. The second thing was a technology surcharge that was put in place. It is sunsetted. It's no longer there. Can get into details if you want, but just wanted to let you know that a couple of those sources have dried up, so there's more reliance than there had been in the past. Only a tad more, as you can see, on the general fund, but more on the other fees that are charged by the office. So again, a net contributor still by a lot, but just wanted to get a sense of the funding. So I just, members, this is not on the PowerPoint, and I'm happy to stop for questions here on the overview of the office, Mr. Chair and members. The next thing I would go to, if there aren't any, is to talk about some of the general concepts legislatively that this office will be working on this session. But if there are any questions about the overview and the function of the office, I'm happy to take them.
Yeah, why don't we pause here for a few questions? I see we have a few member questions. We'll start with Representative Albright and then Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, in some of your earlier comments, you highlighted the new B Corporation. And I'm curious, is that, if you can compare and contrast or reflect upon the interrelationship between a B Corporation and a 501c4, and to that point, in terms of what level of autonomy, what level of potential conflict of interest between a for-profit and a non-profit in terms of lobbyists, in terms of their desire to be transparent about their activities. What jurisdiction and or oversight do you and your role have with those organizations?
Secretary Simon.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Representative Albright, good question. Multi-part question. So the basic difference, in a nutshell, between the two entities that you described is, you know, if there's a for-profit entity, there's a responsibility to, for example, shareholders, if there are shareholders, to maximize revenues, and there's a fiduciary duty often to do that as well. And that has presented problems for for-profit entities that wanted to do something that was whatever they deemed to be socially responsible. And there was sort of a conflict there. So the idea of a B corporation is you can be for-profit and not get into trouble by way of a fiduciary duty or a duty to shareholders by doing something that is perhaps socially conscious but doesn't make as much money as the other path would have made more money. So I think there was a nationally a sense that it was presenting corporate entities with kind of a false choice. Well, either you're a nonprofit, a C3 or C4, or you're a for-profit entity. Well, what if you kind of want to do both? What if Target, for example, I'm using it, they're not a B Corp, but let's say a Target-like entity or retailer said, well, we want to be a retailer. We want to make money. We want to make money for our owners and shareholders and employees and all the rest, but we also want to do something socially conscious without someone saying, without the board or shareholders in a shareholder suit or something else saying, you could have taken path A, which would have made more money for shareholders and increased the dividend, let's say, or you could have taken path B, which would have done this socially conscious thing, whatever the board determines. But because you took B, you know, you didn't fulfill a certain duty. So this is kind of a hybrid to make sure that we're getting rid of that false choice. Minnesota, again, was, I don't know the exact number, but now I think it is a majority of the states. But you raise an interesting issue, Representative Albright, about C4s and about can B Corps, for example, under what guidelines or constraints are they under when it comes to hiring lobbyists or political activity? You know, I have to say that's something I think I should talk with you offline about. I honestly, at this point, am trying to navigate that myself. Figure those out. Unless, and I should say, whether either the business buyers or I don't know, Mr. Black, do you want to add to that?
Mr. Black, welcome to the committee. If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bert Black. I'm the legal advisor to the Office of the Secretary of State and Mr. Chairman and Representative Albright. So the B or Public Benefit Corporation under Chapter 304A is first and foremost a business corporation. And in fact, all the laws pertaining to business corporations, Chapter 302A, do apply to public benefit corporations, except to the extent that 304A has the special rules that Secretary Simon has already referenced. But they are under the same constraints as any other business corporation with respect to, you mentioned the hiring of lobbyists, but they're treated the same as any other business corporation. They're not tax exempt in any way. They are not permitted to be tax exempt. They have to pay taxes if they make a profit. Hopefully they will make a profit. An example of this kind of corporation, we have, right now we have, I believe it's 19 of these. The law just went into effect a couple of weeks ago. We have 19 of them. One organization that is a public benefit corporation is Sunrise Banks, which is just down the road here. Another one you might have heard of is the clothing company Patagonia. Although they're under California law. Obviously these are operating businesses that are striving to make a commercial profit.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Black, then on a follow-up, kind of a segue, if a C-Corp then has a parallel B-Corp, would they have shared governance between those two, or is there a bright line in terms of their governance between the B Corp and the C Corp? And if there isn't, would they also then share the same balance sheet? And how do you account for the ebb and flow on the ledger in terms of the assets of the C Corp and how they're transferred, or vice versa, back and forth between the C Corp and the B Corp? And how do you account or alert shareholders who may appreciate an example, the Patagonia, for the profitability of their clothing line to being a shareholder, but they may not care so much or have less of a distinct desire to participate in the B Corp. Do they have any distinction in terms of participating in one without the other?
Mr. Black.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Albright. Well, first of all, the in the situation you suggest, it seems like the structure there would be that the B Corp would either be a parent or subsidiary of the C Corp. So you have two separate entities which have some relationship to each other. And of course, we have that a lot in regular corporate practice. If the B Corporation were to be the subsidiary, it's highly likely that the board, it would have a separate board, it would have separate accounting, it may or may not file consolidated tax returns. I guess that's really, that's a question for a CPA, I'm only a lawyer. In terms of the investors, in order to form a public benefit corporation in this state, either you form it new, which is of course what has been done for most of these 19, you can also convert an existing business corporation to a public benefit corporation, but you must have a supermajority of the shares in favor of that. So the notion is that people, in fact, really the whole notion of the public benefit corporation is so that people can know going in what their deal is going to be, and in fact that their deal is going to be that they get less profit in the form of dividends, but they're going to be participating in whatever the mission is of the particular corporation, and that could be an environmental mission, an economic mission. There are a variety of kinds of missions. It's limitless. There's one, and there's one more item relating to your question about how do the shareholders know, and that is that starting in starting in 2016, each public benefit corporation will be required to file an annual report, and this will be a detailed explanation of what they have done to further that mission, and that should include, or there are no specific requirements that it include a balance sheet. However, that would be a good idea, and it would be prudent for those organizations to consider that. Those reports will be available publicly on the website of the Office of the Secretary of State, and our belief is that the free market, as well as the Fourth Estate, will shed quite a bit of light on these operations through that annual report. That information is going to be, we believe, highly scrutinized and available 24/7. And so that's also another check on activities of these organizations, and also information for shareholders. Also, I might add that under existing Minnesota law, shareholders are entitled to various records for any corporation that they're an owner of, and they can get that upon request of the corporation, and there's a long list of things, but the most important is the balance sheet, but there are other records that are also available right now.
Thank you, Mr. Black.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary Simon. You talked about the no excuse absentee ballot. Some people confuse that with early voting. I know. What's the difference between the two, I guess, is the question I have, because I've gotten some feedback from county officials that have talked to me saying that while they encourage and they like the no excuse absentee ballot, they think it would be more cost effective for the state and for the counties if we just had early voting, period. And so what's the difference between the two?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, the main difference between, well, generally absentee voting, whether it's no excuses or not, and in-person voting on election day is with an absentee ballot, of course, putting that ballot in an envelope where it's presumably and hopefully guarded under lock and key, and then at some later point is processed, is opened, processed, and then finally tabulated and counted, usually after all the rest of the ballots are closed. So it's not something that's counted and processed that day. As a result, it's more expensive for county administrators. I've heard figures as high as 4-1 in terms of the ratio of a straight-up vote and an absentee vote being four times as expensive. But I suppose that depends from county to county. And obviously, an in-person vote means it's processed immediately right that day. And that's the basic. I've heard some of the same things. I've talked to many of the county auditors and auditor treasurers. They appreciate the convenience that it affords the voters this last cycle of being able to vote from home, being able to vote for your kitchen table, but it is expensive for election administrators. 32 states have early voting, including every state that surrounds us, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin. And, you know, we can talk about in the next segment, you know, how Minnesota might consider that, how this committee might consider that. That's really up to the committee. But I think that's the primary difference, both in terms of cost and kind of the kind of voting as well.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, welcome back to a committee you're very familiar with as well. And just a side note, you travel with a larger entourage than your predecessor did when you go to committees, just for the record. Most of the questions that I had were addressed by Representative Albright, but one of the things I might, as a friendly piece of advice to the Secretary, is you may want to schedule some time with the Chair of the Commerce Committee in the House to explore more the details, because the scope of this committee is government operations, and we kind of bridged into business enterprises and things. While it may be a publicly traded entity, it's not a public government or public enterprise from that standpoint. So just a word to maybe visit with the Commerce Commissioner to brief them, the Commerce Committee and Chair to talk more about that business structure.
Representative Lane.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up a little bit on the B Corps because of a personal interest. My young son-in-law has formed a B Corp out in D.C. His because of his passion to do this more than just for profit, and at this point he's paying by I think three employees, but he hasn't taken a salary himself and is about building the business. However, my daughter, his wife, is also finishing up law school, and she has an interest in this area. She has now said to me that corporate law does not require a corporation to focus only on profit. That's become our thinking in our society. It's a really idea that has developed in our culture over the last couple decades. They're to operate right. They're to operate as a fiscally responsible corporations, but it is not by law a primary concern that you must do everything that will develop profit for your shareholders above and beyond everything else. That's just not in law. She says corporate law is actually very narrow, and this is simply the assumption that we've developed over the last couple decades. So she says B corporations aren't actually necessary except in our consciousness. But regardless, I do approve that the idea of B corporations representing only those corporations who are interested in making a claim right out front in the public that I am about more than just profit. I'm about the environment. I'm about my employees. I'm about my community. And that's a statement they make as they form as a corporation. And I laud that.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Seeing no further member questions at this point, why don't we proceed into your session preview, if that's what you want to call the next phase of your presentation.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And, you know, I probably already overstayed the allotted time, but if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I will I'll go there next and talk about that. And there's no PowerPoint for this period, but I just want to talk generally about concepts. There's no bill language before you. There's no bill before you. But I just want to talk about some concepts that the office is interested in pursuing and discussing with you, either in committee in bill form or otherwise. One is what Representative Nelson just flagged, which is the early voting provision. As I mentioned, 32 other states do this, including all the states that surround us. There are stereotypically red states and stereotypically blue states that do it, I think, with great success. And it just gives people another option. It would be an overlay on top of what we already have. And Mr. Chair, as you know, there was some talk of that 2 years ago. We didn't quite get there, but I think there were some very fruitful discussions that I assume will continue either here in committee or behind the scenes. But that is something that I think particularly, not only because it affords, you know, another advantage to everyday people and citizens, but also because elections administrators are feeling somewhat the weight of this. There are a lot of moving parts to a no-excuses absentee system, and while it affords a lot of access, it is expensive, and to limit some of that pressure, I think an early voting system would be something that would really would make a lot of sense, as 32 other states have found. But that's a discussion, obviously, that's the chair's prerogative and the member's prerogative as well. But that will be a priority. Another one is pre-registration for certain high school students. In most states that do it, and it's just about half, not quite half of the states who have a pre-registration regime, it's 16 and 17-year-olds. And the rationale for 16-year-olds is, well, they're getting their driver's licenses, presumably at that time, or at least they're eligible. So it's another step. It's getting good habits started early. It enables people to, whether it's a civics teacher or someone else in high school, to, at least for a senior class, if not others, talk about getting those good habits started early, pre-registering to vote. Obviously, nothing would kick in until age 18. We all know that. But it would be some way to, you know, help younger people get involved earlier and get a sense of that civic responsibility. So that's another thing. Many of you are familiar with UOCAVA, which is a long acronym. It's federal legislation that has to do with voting rights and special privileges for overseas voters, typically and usually, well, not just overseas and military voters. And we'll have a couple provisions, again, for your consideration there. One would be, just quickly, a provision that would afford all the UOCAVA protections and benefits to National Guard members who are activated on state duty, not federal duty. Right now, believe it or not, it's only those who are activated federally who are afforded some of those protections and some of those privileges. I'll just give you an example that comes up a lot. For example, a member of the National Guard who's activated federally, who's doing an absentee ballot, doesn't need a witness, for example, like the rest of us would. But we have said, and it's a long-standing practice, that no, we're fine accommodating those folks. But there doesn't seem to be a real good reason why someone called up on federal duty as opposed to state should get those privileges. Everyone who puts on the uniform should. So that's one example. Another example that I suspect you'll see that is something that is not at all a partisan issue. Both support and opposition goes both sides of the aisle, and that is a movement of the primary, perhaps to June, perhaps to some other date. I'm not going to talk about the merits. I just wanted to give you an idea of some of the things to put on your radar screen. There are some ballot redesign issues that may be before you, if not this year, then next year. There have been some studies done about the way our ballots look and some improvements that could be made there. We will have the time-honored sort of admin technical bill, and it will contain a few sort of technical changes, everything from eliminating a reference to cassette tapes to making sure that we're specific about closing times or filing deadlines expressed in terms of times, not just days, things like that. And so stay tuned for those details, but there will be a bill that will have maybe a dozen or so, maybe more, changes of that nature. We also expect to be having some discussion, as we have had over the years here in this building and in the legislature, about redistricting reform. This seems to be a good time to discuss it, no matter what your proposed solution is, because it's the middle of the decade. We're far enough from the last redistricting that anyone who is upset over it for whatever reason has gotten over it, hopefully, and we're far enough from the next one, and this is probably the most important. We're far enough from the next redistricting that nobody, not even the most intense political pundit, is handicapping the 2020 legislative elections at this point. Probably not even the 2018. So no one is of a mind right now to make a decision on redistricting reform based on whether their political party is likely to be in the driver's seat after the 2020 election. That's when we're going to elect the next set of mapmakers. And I don't know of anyone, even the most far-seeing pundit, who's handicapping the 2020 Minnesota House and Senate races. So it's a good time, it seems to me, to have the discussion about what reforms we want without regard to who's going to be the mapmakers at that time. So those are just some of the things. There may be others that arise as well that I just wanted to offer for the committee's consideration. There will be bills coming, and we'll have a good discussion. And as always, I just wanted to end, before I stand for any questions, if there are any, by saying I want to be personally accessible and open to all of you. I know so many of you, obviously, but even if I didn't, out of respect to you and your constituents, I want to be completely open to you. I hope you'll feel free to stop on by or call the office. I'm happy to come to your office and meet with you at any time to take your suggestions, concerns, criticisms, anything you have. I want to be open and accessible, whether that means coming down unannounced on the first floor or setting up a meeting with your LA to meet with you in your offices or meeting with your constituents. I just want to be open, and I'm willing, for that matter, to work with anyone from any corner of the state, from any political party, to work on the goals of this office. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. I think we do have at least a couple questions. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary Simon. You talked about the HAVA money that no longer is there, and I think that goes back 16 years almost, or about 16 years of that Bush-Gore election that brought that about. And we all know equipment ages, and is depending on where it gets used, it wears out. Are we looking at some way, and I know we're not the budget part of this, but it's probably a policy issue that also, that are we looking at setting up some way of helping counties, and especially some of the rural outstate counties that don't have a huge tax base, to be able to fund that equipment and come up with a fund that the state can set up to allow people to use to get at, to be able to update that equipment as necessary so that all of our citizens can have an equal opportunity to vote and have their vote cast.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, thank you. That's a great question, a very timely issue. I'm glad you raised it, actually. I should have. This is an issue because of HAVA money drying up. It means that a lot of jurisdictions are now or very soon facing the prospect of buying new election equipment. Now, it is a one-time expense. The useful life of these election machines is usually 10 to 15 years, but you can do the math. Since the aftermath of the 2000 election, not everyone bought it in 2001, 2002, 2003, but even if they bought it in 5, 6, 7, it's going to start to come due. So maybe not this year in the 2016 cycle, but certainly in 2018 and certainly by 2020, almost every jurisdiction, those that haven't already, is going to need to replace that equipment. And in case you're wondering, at least the current generation of equipment, and I have no idea what the next generation will be, it's about $5,000 or $6,000 a pop. And even a small county that might only have 20-some polling places in the entire county, you can do the math there. Even though it's a one-time expense only once every decade, decade and a half, that's a big expense to sort of have to swallow all at once for any jurisdiction. It's not just small counties, it's any. But some of the smaller counties have particularly voiced some concern about that one-time expense. So over the years, I know there has been talk, and obviously it's your prerogative, either in this committee or others, to talk about whether it makes sense to have some dedicated funding pool in the state so that counties, again, only once a decade and a half, can draw on that money to buy election equipment. And, you know, the legislature, all of you can put in whatever guardrails you want, report to the legislature, it has to meet certain criteria, all the rest. You can write into statute whatever you want, but there, it seems to me there is some wisdom there. Obviously, the tricky part here is you can't put a fee on anything elections related because that's an unconstitutional poll tax. Of course, everyone acknowledges that. So you have to find something. The most common thing that's been talked about is a driver's license, adding, say, I'm just picking a number here, 50 cents on a driver's license. Now, it's never comfortable to raise a fee on anything. No one likes to do it. No legislator likes to do it. And so that's for your consideration. But I offer it because I think you're going to start to hear from more and more counties as the equipment ages out, because it's a real sock to the budget and to the county pocketbook. One time, it's true, but it's a big one, 5,000 or 6,000. And the small counties have 20, maybe 30 polling places. You can imagine the larger counties with dozens and dozens and scores and hundreds of polling places with all the precincts, what they're going to face at $5,000 or $6,000 a pop. And that's the current generation. I have no idea. I haven't talked to the vendors about what the price is likely to be for the future generation. So that is, Representative Nelson, something for all of you, all of us, I guess, to consider, but particularly you as legislators to consider. Do we want a dedicated pot of funding with not some non-voting-based fee, driver's license, some other license, that would fund the money that can be drawn upon by counties on a basis that you would define in statute?
Yep. Thank you, Representative Nelson and Secretary. So obviously a good thing and a good conversation to be having so that everyone involved, cities, counties, townships all across the state, are aware that we're having the conversation and that this is coming in some form or another so we all can prepare. Any other questions for the Secretary while he is here? Seeing none, I'll ask one question. Where do you think your office will be? Where is the program at right now with electronic poll books? Do you think we'll be able to have some discussions about moving that forward? Obviously, there's a cost component to that.
Right.
But how receptive are we in moving in that direction?
Mr. Chair and members, the issue of electronic poll books is an interesting one. I think Representative Lane, among others, is quite an expert because she served along with, I can't remember everyone, but I know Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Bonoff, there were some from each party in each chamber equally divided, served on a commission or committee for the last year and a half, maybe even longer, 2 years maybe, Representative Lane. And so I know Representative Lane was one of the people who served on that. I think the bottom line is I find the technology really promising. And for those of you who are new to the concept, the idea is, well, electronic poll books, which sounds fancier than it is. It could be just it could be a tablet, it could be a laptop like this, a way to more easily process people on election day. And there are some exciting kind of new frontiers that can be done in terms of efficiency. I know Representative Lane, you and others talked about in the future at some point. My understanding of the report is that now it's not probably feasible either from a cost or other standpoint, but in the future it could include, you know, other data on it, identifying data, things like that. But the point is, I think that's our future. There is a big cost issue. I mean, just as we talked about voting equipment, you know, having a tablet or an electronic poll book, whatever it may be, in every precinct is going to present some cost issues. But I think the technology, as Representative Lane could attest and maybe wants to comment on, is very promising. And election administrators like it. And we had two pilot projects that the legislature, again, on a bipartisan basis, authorized. One in 2013 in the so-called kind of off-year, odd-year elections. And the committee, if you remember, Mr. Chair, you were involved in that, authorized this pilot project, and it was divided pretty equally, I think, picking a handful of precincts in urban, suburban, and in rural precincts, so that there was a true cross-section of different kinds of voting experiences. And the same thing happened in 2014 as well, in this last election. So, and it wasn't the same jurisdictions either, but it was urban. There was some overlap, but urban, suburban, and rural as well. And so I think there's ongoing discussion and interest, certainly by elections administrator. If cost were no object, I think, which it always is, but if cost were no object, I think there would be probably, my guess, a spike in use of electronic poll books from the standpoint of efficiency. But cost is a factor. So, you know, Mr. Chair, I don't know if Representative Lane cares to comment, but she was deeply involved, I know, as others were.
Sure. Representative Lane, care to comment?
I'll just make a comment that I, for instance, a district, a city in my district, St. Anthony, which is divided between Hennepin County and Ramsey County, did it both this time, I believe, and absolutely loved it. It was very, very, very efficient and very accurate to have people coming in and being signed in by the electronic tablet. And but it, my understanding is it's a couple thousand dollars per precinct, so it really adds up. So we need to help these folks.
Thank you, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Secretary Simon, a question for you. How many expatriate voters do we have in the state of Minnesota?
Sorry, Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, meaning who reside outside the state for
yep.
any, and expatriate, usually that term is you describe people who live in foreign countries, but you mean people who just don't presently live in Minnesota, but who are Minnesota residents.
Mr. Chair, yes.
You know, Representative Nash, I confess I don't have that number offhand, but that's easily gettable for you. So Ms. Strother just tells me it's in a report that I know of that I can easily get to you. I don't know the number.
Chair. Representative Nash. Thank you very much. I'd look forward to getting that information.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As it relates to the electronic poll books, there was the very small pilot project that was done. If I'm not mistaken, Representative Lane, it was in city elections in 2013 in Minneapolis, and that was going well and was broadened out into the 14 general elections. I would be interested in having, if our schedule permits, Mr. Chair, an update from the jurisdictions that had done that and from the Secretary's office, as well as to the pluses, the minuses, the stumbling blocks, the wins and successes. If we are as a state going to move to that direction, I think it's extremely important that this committee that has jurisdiction over government operations and elections learn more about that and be able to have a comfort level, not only to for ourselves, but for our other compatriots that are in the legislature, because this is a an area that isn't exactly voter ID, and it's not exactly what everybody's excited about, but it does show promise. So,
thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. We certainly will dig into it. Representative Lane, comment.
A quick
on
comment.
That.
I believe a part of the legislation that had the 2014 had those areas do a report to the Secretary of State about their results. Not a formal study, but a report back.
Representative Nelson.
I guess on the same line, my question, I've been spending too much time with Representative O'Driscoll because my question is about the same thing. Are we going to get a report back to us on the results from that, how it worked, glitches, all that stuff, so going forward we can have a better way to analyze that?
Ms. Strother.
Chair, we are doing a report. The legislation required it to be due April 1st. Our goal is to get it to you, obviously, earlier than that. We did do a debrief with the counties that used the technology. and also the counties that had explored using the technology and then declined to use it this last election. I know folks are interested in having that discussion and having it brought to the legislature too. So,
Representative Nelson.
Follow up. I've heard in the past that there's a problem with the driver's license photos being moved over. Is that glitch being able to get worked out, or?
Ms. Strother.
Chair, the poll books that were in use in 2014 didn't include photos. It was an electronic version of our current poll book system. It's, I believe, a question for DVS. They were the ones that spoke to the ability of to transfer photos and to use photos and the reliability of photos in the task force. But the poll books that are in use now are an electronic version of our paper poll books. They do not contain photos.
Representative O'Driscoll, pass. Seeing no further member questions, we'll give you the final word, Mr. Secretary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members again. Thank you for having me. I know you're getting a lot of overviews and a lot of information. I just appreciate the privilege of being before you again, and I hope it's not the last time. And I really do mean it. I mean, I'm just here on the first floor, and I hope others, all of you, the members and staff, feel free to call or drop by or invite me to set up a meeting with your legislative assistant. I really want to be as open and accessible as possible and hear your ideas, thoughts, criticisms, anything else. So thanks for the opportunity, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you again for taking your time here today. We certainly open invitation from this committee to your office on anything that you would need to come before us on. So we look forward to working with you. We expect to have some good discussions and have some good product for the state of Minnesota. With that, members, we'll say thank you to the Secretary. Tuesday we will not have committee. Wednesday we will be hearing some bills. We will post those sometime tomorrow. And then Thursday we'll have some overviews and introductions from a few other folks. So with that, we are adjourned.